In the summer of 1980, a woman in Watsonville, California, turned down a dance with a stranger. Something about him made her want to go home early instead. A few months earlier, in Hernando County, Florida, a woman walking a rural road recognized a familiar van pulling up beside her. And in Tampa, a woman finishing a game of pool at her favorite bar left with a man none of the regulars recognized. Three women, three ordinary nights, one man moving between them. Some of them made it home. Most of them didn't. This is their story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Karina Smith.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
I am so excited to share that we have a lot of new listeners.
We do.
So, two quick things. One, if you like our podcast, one of the best and easiest ways to support Vanessa and I in sharing these stories is to go and leave us a review. That helps our podcast get out to more people who can hear the stories of missing and unidentified women.
Right. And we're still relatively new. So any support we can get really, really helps.
Exactly. Second, really quickly, I was just looking at our schedule. This episode is releasing while I am going to be in Ireland and Northern Ireland.
I think you should tell everybody why you're going to be in Ireland.
Because it connects to what we're talking about. So I am going to be at Ulster at the Disappearance Studies Conference talking about approaches to telling disappearance stories, along with a whole bunch of brilliant academic people who are going to be talking about their research into disappearance. And so I'm extending it into 2 weeks in Ireland. So extra special shout out to our Ireland listeners.
Right. And what's really cool about that is you get to represent artists.
Yeah. So they're on the heavily academic side. Mm-hmm. I'll be talking more about artistic approaches and ways to use art to communicate stories to people.
Which is what we do here.
Exactly. So that's what I wanted to start with. Also, though, this episode in specific, I want to give some content warnings because I personally probably wouldn't have wanted to come across this without some advanced notice. Number one, this episode does include instances of sexual assault. Two, some of that does include children. We keep this information as brief as possible. But again, that is not something that I, as a survivor, would have wanted to come across. Yes. Three, this is being told over the course of two episodes. It has many instances of disappearance, one of which is still unsolved today. So, Vanessa, ready?
I'm ready.
June 19th, 1980. 18-year-old Pam Sherrill walks along a rural road in Hernando County, Florida. She's not far from home, but it's the cusp of summer, and distances can seem pretty long in the heat of summer in this corner of rural Florida. In the steam shimmering off the hot asphalt, Pam spotted a white van. It was Billy Mansfield. He'd actually given her a ride earlier. Billy wasn't from Florida, but the 24-year-old man had moved down there with his parents and siblings a few years before, and the Mansfields had become very well known in this part of the county. Pam likely didn't know why Billy was circling back. Perhaps she'd wondered if she'd forgotten something in his van, but maybe she thought he wanted to ask her out because Billy was constantly asking girls and women out. But Pam likely didn't anticipate what happened next. Billy stopped his van, got out, grabbed her by the arm, and forced her into the van. He then drove her to the white mobile home he'd been renting, and once there, he propositioned her for sex. When she refused, he grabbed her by the hair and dragged her through the trailer. Placing a knife at her throat, he tied a rope around her left wrist, and after she was bound, he unzipped her pants. What Billy didn't know was that he hadn't hidden the knives inside his home. In the scuffle, Pam had grabbed a knife from the kitchen counter and had cut the rope at her wrist. "I'll cut your throat if you touch me again," she said. And then Pam ran for the door. She threw the knife and rope at him and fled. Pam had cuts to her lip and bruises to her neck when she reported the assault to the police. First he was nice, and then he changed. He acted as if he could kill the whole world, like he hated the whole world, Pam would say later. A warrant for false imprisonment and battery was issued, and Billy Mansfield Jr. was officially a wanted man. Pam got away that day, but not everyone did. Weekiwachee Acres is the kind of place where everyone kind of minded their own business. It's Florida scrub country where properties sit at a distance from one another and pickup trucks kicked up thick plumes of dust when driving down the largely unpaved roads. Virginia and William Mansfield Sr. had moved from Michigan to Florida, settling in a trailer in Weekiwachee Acres. Their six sons and daughter had come with them. Now, the property seemed to be an ever-revolving cast of characters as the kids cycled in and out of the home. Even in this neighborhood, though, they stand out. Their property was soon littered with junk cars and trash, and neighbors started to be more cautious walking down Central Wood, the main street through Weekiwachee Acres. Billy and his brothers would often tear down the road. They said they would go 100 miles an hour. But on June 14th, the neighbor's annoyance with loud parties, the junk, the speeding would turn to shock when William Mansfield Sr. was arrested and charged with 5 counts of fondling and sexually assaulting children between the ages of 4 to 13. Days later, on June 17th, he was charged with 6 more counts, including lascivious assault and procuring a person under the age of 16 for prostitution. 2 days later, when Pam made her report to police about being forced into a van and assaulted, the name Billy Mansfield was already burned into law enforcement officers' brains. They were already investigating a massive sexual abuse and assault case against his father. So they moved in quickly to arrest Billy.
So both of these things are going on at the same time?
Yes. So okay. That's one interesting thing I would say about this timeline. This is all happening in this concentrated amount of time.
So both men are discovered for their crimes at the same...
Yeah, we're within days.
Within days. Wow.
Everyone's talking about the Mansfields at this point. So when they go to arrest him, they can't find him. They ask neighbors in Weekiwachee to keep watch and alert for any sign that Billy might be in the area. On June 20th, one of the Mansfields' neighbors spotted Billy at Weekiwachee Acres, and they made a call only to watch him drive away. Shortly after, though, he came back, and so she made another call, this time hoping the Hernando County Sheriffs would be able to apprehend Billy. It took 22 minutes for them to respond, and by then, Billy was gone. And those 22 minutes meant that Billy was free to attack again, and he would.
It's always depressing when we talk about the stories where somebody could have been stopped, and they're not, and then they just go on to keep doing more and more and more. And I have a feeling that's what we're getting ready for.
That's absolutely going to happen. And you know, 22 minutes, it seems like an incredibly long time. We're talking about it's not exactly a place to quickly get to. So okay. Even if you respond quickly, that 22 minutes means a lot.
Because it seems like nothing in a regular course of a day.
Months later, and thousands of miles away, a young woman named Patricia Schindler was working at the Beach Street Cafe, one of Watsonville, California's newest locations. That fall, there was a new guy in town named Billy, and he'd stop by the cafe regularly, and he was very persistent in asking her out. And Patricia, she would always say no. On Saturday, December 6, 1980, Patricia found herself out at a bar called the Wooden Nickel 2. She wasn't really surprised to see Billy there. The bar was a local mainstay, particularly for locals and blue-collar workers, and Billy was out working at the Miranda Mushroom Farm, and a couple of the guys who worked there were with him that night. When Billy caught sight of Patricia, he made a beeline for her, and this time he came on stronger than he had at her workplace. With a drink in his hand, he tried to embrace her and kissed her. Patricia was normally the talkative type, but with Billy, she barely responded. But that didn't seem to matter to him. He just kept a steady stream of conversation with her. The entire time, Patricia barely listened. She just kept thinking about how she wanted him to leave her alone. Finally, he dropped a question she didn't expect. Would she go to Colorado with him? Patricia said later, "I just picked up these bad vibes. I just didn't like him. I felt like something wasn't right. I like people and those blue eyes of his, but something inside just said, don't go with him." So Patricia turned him down. This didn't seem to matter to him. He just turned his attention to her friend Kim Powell, and he asked the 19-year-old to slow dance with him, and she complied, but he was awkward and clumsy, and she also seemed put off by him. He then asked her if she wanted to do cocaine with him, but she shot him down too. As the evening went on, another woman, Renee Salling, she showed up at the bar. Across from the bar, Patricia kept an eye on Renee. She said she thought she recognized her. And then she realized that Renee had gone to school with her sister. In Patricia's words, Renee was wasted that night, and it was very obvious she was drunk. So obvious that the bar owner asked her to leave and escorted her out through the kitchen of the bar. Not far behind her was Billy. Patricia watched the two leave and then turned to Kim. "It's 11 and already he scored," she said. Patricia would be one of the last to see Renee alive. On the night of December 6th, Renee had gone to the bar looking for her husband, Raymond. And the two had gotten into a fight again, and she just wanted to speak with him, but Raymond wasn't there. Renee didn't have a license, and she'd stopped driving her vehicle after the brakes had gone out. It's something that really did complicate her life. She was a mom of three young sons between the ages of 8 years old and 3 months old, living in a rural county. So she got around the best she could, and often that meant taking rides with strangers. Everyone believed that's what she was doing that night when she got into Billy's car. Her younger sister Jean said she'd warned Renee in the past about getting into a car with someone she didn't know, but Renee actually had very few options. Now, Renee is the kind of beautiful that everyone noticed. Her sister Marta said she was the type of girl you'd look at the same time say, "I wish I looked like her." So it might not be surprising that people remembered a woman with long dark hair leaving the bar with Billy that night. One of those was a man named Louis. He worked with Billy out at the Mushroom Farm. Like Patricia, he'd watched Renee leave the bar with Billy, but he'd also noticed when Billy came back in. Soon, Billy was heading over to him. "Want to meet a chick," Billy said. Louis said, "Where?" And Billy responded, "I got her in my car," and gave him the keys to his Oldsmobile Toronado. "Just don't let her out. Keep her locked up," Billy said, and Louis made his way to the parking lot.
It's kind of an alarming thing to tell somebody.
Yeah. Keep her locked in.
Yeah. I wonder how Louis handled that.
Louis goes out to the car and he sees the same dark-haired woman that Billy had left the bar with. And she was sitting in the car. She seemed drunk, so he sat in the front seat. And he said he tried to talk to her. And he said that he was worried about her and tried to ask her questions. But English was not his first language, so with that and the way she was slurring her words, he really couldn't understand what she was trying to say to him. So he left the car. The next morning, a woman driving to the local dump spotted a woman's body in a water-filled ditch along Buena Vista Road, which was only 4 miles from the bar. It was Renee. The medical examiner's report would tell the tale of some of the brutality she experienced, including scratches and bruises that indicated that she'd been dragged, and internal trauma to her skull that also showed that she had maybe fought back. It was believed that she'd been strangled to death using a long black cord that had been found beneath her body, and they also believed that it was possible that she might have been sexually assaulted. On Monday, Billy shows up for work like nothing has happened. And one of his coworkers said that he seemed depressed and that he spent most of the workday sitting in his van. Others just assumed that he was hungover because everyone knew that Billy had a drinking problem. He even kept stashes of alcohol hidden around the farm so that he could drink on the job. But Louis had heard rumors that the sheriff's office was looking for Billy, and his mind went back to that woman who'd been seen in Billy's car Saturday night. "What did you do, Billy?" Louis said. "I don't know, but thanks," Billy said. Within 15 minutes, Billy was gone. Without even clocking out for the day, he left the farm. By the time the sheriff's office reached the KOA campground Billy had been staying at with his brother Gary, the brothers were long gone. Yet again, they'd been too late.
He keeps getting almost caught. Louis knew, and I gather that if they would have talked to anybody at the bar that night, all fingers would be pointing at Billy anyways, right?
Yeah, so this is actually going pretty quickly. They absolutely know that one of their primary suspects is Billy. So Renee's body is found Sunday morning. By Monday, they're piecing together. They've talked to bar patrons. They've gotten a name. And so on Monday, they're trying to find him.
That's making this unique to what we usually talk about, because they know and they just keep
just missing
him. Not getting him. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so close every time. Their investigation, it does bring them, though, to this KOA campground where a clearer picture of just who they're dealing with has begun to emerge. Billy had been living there with his common-law wife, Maureen, his brother, Gary, Gary's wife, Liz, and Gary and Liz's three children. They'd actually been staying in an orange tent and a 12-foot trailer since they'd rolled into town in around the middle of summer. In the few months they'd been there, Billy had already gained a reputation. He'd often solicit campers, teenage campers, for sex. And then there was the trash. The Mansfields were angering everyone because they would leave their litter on the campground. They would throw the dirty diapers and other trash into the fire rings. They were just causing all sorts of issues at this campground.
But how old is he at this point?
He is in his 20s, so we have a grown man, and they use the term soliciting teenagers for sex, but that is rape.
That's rape. I was about to say, it sounds like he's just raping kids in the campground.
That's what is going on here.
Huh.
Now, Jane Greenwood, she's the assistant manager of the campground, and she says he's got the strangest expression in his eyes. When he looks at you, it's as if he's not even seeing you. They are really weird eyes. They give you the creeps.
Amy, this is the second time now, and we're not even that far into this, where you've mentioned his eyes.
Yes. This is actually one of the things that gets brought up all the time about Billy Mansfield, is what his eyes look like. Now, some people describe them as being beautiful. There's one woman who ends up describing them as being, quote, as pretty as a girl's.
The first time you brought it up, it was in that they're pretty blue eyes. Mm-hmm. And then this time, they're weird, creepy.
And there are other people who describe them as being the creepiest eyes that they have seen. But it's actually Maureen, Billy's common-law wife, who had the most to say. Billy's coworkers actually thought that Maureen was dead because he told them that she had died during an epileptic seizure and that he'd been bereft about her death at work. I thought, God, this guy is going through hell, one of his coworkers said.
Did they ever say why he said that?
Yeah, well, so the reality is far different, because Maureen and actually Liz had both left Billy and Greg that November. So they had just up and ditched the brothers. And so instead of saying that his wife left him, his common-law wife left him, he's telling this story that she died. He'd often had beaten Maureen, and she began to fear that he would kill her, which is why she left. But also he had started bringing people back to their place and forcing her to have sex with them. And at one point, she says that he brought back a teen girl to the campsite and made Maureen watch. Again,
this watching is a rape.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, that wasn't all of it. He also had told her that he'd been having sex with his coworkers and that he also liked to watch bestiality. But it was what her sister-in-law had told her that is perhaps even more shocking than all of that, which is that Liz had told her that Billy had killed a girl named Sally back in Tampa and that he'd picked her up at a bar and then left her body by the road. If that was true, investigators thought there was the possibility that they were looking at multiple murders across at least two states. The only problem was, there weren't any reports of an unsolved murder involving someone named Sally back in Florida.
We'll be back in a moment.
So there was never Sally?
There's not. There may not have been, but there actually was a young woman named Sandra Jean Graham. Months before Renee was murdered and months before Pam Sherrill would make her escape from Billy Mansfield Jr.'s trailer, 21-year-old Sandra had headed out to a bar in Tampa, Florida. It was April 26, 1980, and Sandra was having a rough week. The divorcee had recently broken up with her boyfriend, and so she headed out to one of her favorite places and one of the places that she felt most at home, Pam's Lounge. Pam's was just a few short miles from her house, and Sandra was a regular who knew all the other regulars. Now, this bar is something that's described as intimate because it's one of those places where there's not a lot of space and people would gather around the horseshoe-shaped bar. But what Sandra loved the most was the pool table. She played anytime she could and particularly liked doing doubles. That night, Sandra got to Pam's around 9:30 p.m., and she didn't have a lot of time to play because daylight savings time was that night and the bar was set to close an hour early. Around the same time Sandra got there, so did a stranger. The regulars did not recognize him, but before you know it, Sandra and the man were playing pool. She was that way. Sandy liked to have a good time, one of the regulars said. Now, Sandy was drinking that night. It wasn't unusual, but she also wasn't drunk. At some point, Sandy ended her pool game with the man and walked to talk to her friend, another regular at Pam's. And that's when the newcomer grew angry. He seemed upset by the fact that she would be talking to someone else, even though they'd just met, so he picked up her keys and threw them in the trash. Around 12:30 to 1:30 a.m., Sandra and the man went outside the bar to talk, and everyone thought she would be back in a few minutes. And one of the other patrons, he fished her keys out of the trash and placed them on the bar for her. But Sandra never returned, and neither did the man.
So are we thinking that Liz got the names mixed up, and Sandra is the Sally person that she was talking about?
This is a theory that's going to develop over time.
Okay.
That Sunday, Sandra, she misses her daily phone call to her parents. And they'd last seen her on Friday because she'd stopped to show them the new couch she was taking to her apartment. And she called them nearly every day. So they are always expecting to hear from her. Later that day, her father, Jack, got a phone call. It was a friend of Sandra's who'd been at Pam's Lounge. Sandra's keys and cigarettes were still on the bar, and if that wasn't alarming enough, so were her glasses. Sandra had particularly bad eyesight and needed her glasses. Added to that, her car was still outside in the parking lot. Jack would later say she wouldn't leave her keys and glasses and car like that if she weren't in trouble. Jack drove down to Pam's and got to work trying to figure out what happened to his daughter. He collected the names of everyone who was at the bar that night. And on Monday morning, he made his way to the Tampa police station. He filed a report and he gave them the list. Even in the initial report, it was clear something was wrong. Her keys were on the bar. Her friends didn't know where she was. She hadn't shown up to her job as a clerk at the pro shop at Hillsborough Community College. So on the form, there was a question. Is foul play suspected? And the officer checked yes. Sandra Jean Graham was missing, and police believed from the start that someone had murdered her.
And they, of course, never knew it was Billy that night, right?
So no one at this point knows who it is.
Because he's a stranger there.
He's a stranger. They assign this case to Detective Mark Blazo, and he's working Sandra's missing persons case. So he spends months collecting witness statements and having a composite drawing of the primary suspect drawn up. Out in California, meanwhile, law enforcement is dealing with their own investigation, the murder of Renee, and trying to locate her murderer. It's now December 9th. Billy and his brother are still on the run. But the Toronado was found abandoned in Sacramento. It appeared to have been broken down. And though the men weren't in sight, it was a strong clue into what direction they might have gone.
So the brothers always just move as a pair. Since Maureen and Liz and the kids left them, they're just always together?
They are often together. Now, their luck in evading authorities, and Vanessa, I know you've been waiting to hear that, is quickly running out. The following day, a rookie cop spotted their van in Winnemucca, Nevada. He'd been keeping up on the teletypes and noted that the van matched the description of one being sought for a murder out of Santa Cruz County, so he pulled the van over. Inside, the men gave their names, but the cop was still suspicious. They looked like the guys wanted in Santa Cruz for a murder of a woman named Renee, but the names were different.
So are they traveling with different identities at this point?
I don't think they've managed to collect IDs at this point, but they've just given him fake names. He's not buying it at all.
Okay.
And so 4 days after Renee is murdered, Billy Mansfield is finally in custody. He gets arrested. And with him, so is his brother, Gary. Just days later, the two are arraigned in a Watsonville courtroom. Both entered the courthouse wearing paper bags over their heads.
Why?
They actually become known as the paper bag brothers because of this move, and according to the Santa Cruz Sentinel, it's done because the district attorney's office insisted that it would help avoid damaging the testimony of potential witnesses.
So it was not Billy and Gary's turn?
No. So this is done as like make sure that the court case ends up going smoothly later.
So the DA is just like, let's just bag their heads?
Yeah, because both brothers are pretty distinctive in appearance. Billy is initially charged with a single count of murder, and Gary is charged with being an accessory to that murder. And they both pleaded innocent.
And that's for Renee?
This is for Renee. Back in Florida, a few weeks after this arrest, Detective Mike Blazo gets a phone call. He was asked if he knew about a man named Billy Mansfield, whose family lived in Wiggiewatchee Acres, but who had once lived down in Tampa. Now, to Blazo, Mansfield is a relative unknown, but when he saw a photo of Billy Mansfield and he compared it to the drawing he had done of the suspect in Sandra's disappearance, they really seemed to match, especially around the eyes. Blazo remembered people talking about those eyes. They'd been piercing and angry looking. Now, to him, the comparison between the drawing and the man was what he had been waiting for. After all these people and all these months, he said, when I saw that, I just about cried.
So all those connections are being made now.
Yeah. So he's like, this could be the guy that I've been looking for months. But he quickly learned more about Billy's history. That despite being only in his early 20s, Billy Mansfield had a lengthy criminal history and a very complicated past.
Is it going to be necessary for us to know that to understand the story of what happened to these women?
I think so. I'm going to keep this as quick as possible because there is plenty of other places you can really dive into Billy Mansfield's history. And I really want to keep us more focused on the women. Mm-hmm. But I also think it's necessary to understand a little bit more about him to understand the scope of violence that he did through the entirety of his life.
Yeah, context matters.
So we're going back to when Billy was 14 and he was living with his family in Michigan. This is the first time he is accused of a sexual assault. He's accused of molesting a fellow 14-year-old girl on her walk home from school. Her parents actually wouldn't let her testify against him, so he was left with only a stern warning. Later, Chet Bush of the Kent County Sheriff's Department said, "We couldn't stop Billy because we never could get anyone to testify." Billy's life, it moves pretty quickly. By 16, he'd quit school, lied his way into the army, and was quickly discharged. Before he's even 20, he'd married, had two children, and moved with his family to Florida. Billy ends up moving between these two states pretty regularly, so that's something that's going to be important moving forward. In 1974, he's charged with forcing two women to perform what were called, quote, immoral acts on him. The women here are willing to talk about it, but the jury actually ends up finding him innocent.
Do we know why?
They said basically they just couldn't believe that this one person could force two women at the same time to do something.
Doesn't that happen often enough?
It does, but
okay.
In 1974, they're just saying that's not possible. And this is where the inability to hold him accountable in a meaningful way, this continues. By the time he's 21, he's extradited from Tampa, Florida, back to Michigan, where he pleads guilty to another sex crime. This time, he'd been convicted of having criminal sexual conduct with a 16-year-old babysitter in Grand Rapids. He doesn't spend long in jail. It's just a six-month sentence.
Very slippery. Like, he just keeps barely having any repercussions.
Exactly. He's released, and just a few months later, on December 31st, 1977, he picked up two girls. They were just 15 and 16, and he grabbed them while they were walking. And he held them at knife point and drove them to a wooded area and sexually assaulted them. One of them would just say that he kept on apologizing to her the entire time. The other said that he apologized too, and he blamed it on drinking too much, and he said that he was lonely and needed some friends.
I'm glad the girl still spoke up. That what if there's other people we don't know about, and Spiel just kind of made them not report him?
Yeah, so I think that it's highly likely, given his history, that there are plenty of other victims of him
that we'll just never know about.
Yeah, who have not found a safe place to share their story. Billy, after this happens, he flees to Michigan, goes back to Florida. He's arrested again on February 6, 1979, and he's sent back to Michigan on these charges. While he's in prison this time, his marriage to his wife, Phyllis, officially ends. Again, he serves very little time for these crimes because in what is later called a controversial deal, Billy provides statements against another inmate, a man named Albert Lee III. Lee had told Billy that he'd murdered Linda Vanderveen, an 11-year-old girl. And so Billy provides information on this crime in exchange for getting out early. So by February 6th, 1980, Billy is out. He'll end the year having assaulted Pamela, killed Renee, and be a suspect in the disappearance of Sandra Graham. But that would not be the end of this story. In March 1981, while Billy is in jail in California, a man named Bob Gattinella was heading home in Florida. He'd been digging ditches in Hernando County for the county road department and decided to take a shortcut through Weekiwachee Acres, and that's when he was flagged down. "You think you can take some ground for us?" he was asked by a member of law enforcement, and Bob agreed. By the end of the month, what Bob helped unearth had his coworkers giving him a new nickname, the Body Snatcher. Vanessa, we are going to have to end here.
There's still more, isn't there?
There is so much more, because in the next episode, we're going to learn what Bob found, how that culminated in almost 3 decades or more of searching, and how an unnamed victim known only as Hernando County Jane Doe is still waiting to get her name back.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, March Held, read by Karina Smith. Karina is a violinist and multi-instrumentalist who has toured with Adam Ezra Group for the past 14 years. With a background in music education, she maintains her teaching license in her home state of Massachusetts. Beyond the stage, Karina is passionate about using music as a force for good, helping hundreds of concertgoers register to vote through her Folking Vote initiative and supporting Rally Sound's mission to empower communities through music. Whether performing, teaching, or volunteering, she believes music has the power to connect people and inspire meaningful change.
March Held. Unidentified woman discovered March 19, 1981 in Weekiwachee, Florida. "What color is the month of March?" someone asks, and all I think is Florida blue. The sky washed pale by the spring sun, or the blue-green depths of the Weekiwachee mermaid tanks, where they have been held captive for decades, their slim tails flitting along the bottom, hands catching on the rough rocks. They're always smiling there, always beauty queen waving at every tourist hoping for a glimpse of skin moving through the water. But maybe March is limestone white, the dust billowing behind a car driving too fast, the snap of pool balls colliding on a table as cigarette smoke hovers in a neighborhood bar, drinks sweating in the still air. Perhaps it's gold, the sharp glint of hotel lights on wire-rimmed glasses, and the steady stretch of sand worked over by decades of spring breakers, the hot granules catching every nervous dance move. But maybe that's not March at all. Here, in a stretch of Florida, where a man digs deep into the ground, his machine working over and over to gently pry what the soil has kept hidden below. How can March be a month without you now? This is how we will mark time. Not color, but gestures. One hand brushing the dirt from another.
For more information about our show, please visit shegoesbyjanepodcast.com.
Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.